Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host again for this edition. President Biden delivered a stirring State of the Union address this week, reiterating a number of pledges he made during his 2020 campaign, including expanding Medicare coverage and banning assault-style weapons and some kind of policing reform to address the rampant problem of police brutality. But now that voters gave Republicans a slim majority in the House, it's unlikely that any meaningful reforms or improvements will be enacted in the next 2 years. If any so-called bipartisan agreements are reached, it will likely require compromises in other areas. And Republicans have an advantage when it comes to litigation now, with right-wing majority on the Supreme Court and many Trump-appointed federal judges, as well as Republican domination in state and judiciaries and legislatures in many states. So while Biden's promising rhetoric may have offered progressives a moment of optimistic rejoice, the struggle ahead remains just as urgent. And at this time, there's a movement afoot, albeit a small one, to pressure Biden to step aside in 2024 in the campaign and to let a younger, more progressive candidate seek the nomination. National polls among likely Democratic voters show there's widespread preference for a new face at the helm. Some, however, are citing what they describe as Biden's failures in office, such as the failure to take executive action on student debt relief or to undertake meaningful immigration reforms. Of course, there is some merit to that analysis, but every executive order can be seen as a failure of Congress to reach an amicable compromise, and with Republicans generally holding fast, voting rigidly along party lines, the Biden administration's hands have been largely tied. What then is the value of amplifying such criticism of Biden, which may be perceived as a condemnation by those who would oppose him? Folks like Roots Action's Jeff Cohen are heading up a Don't Run Joe pressure campaign, and although their motivations may be valid, I'm concerned about their net effect. In my view, it would be better to quietly build up support for a more desirable candidate than to tear down the current administration, critiques of which should be limited to policies and actions and always paired with positive proposals. Wouldn't it be refreshing if in the next primary a younger woman of color emerges as the top challenger and speaks in terms of building upon the Biden legacy of good achievements rather than wasting valuable time and energy attacking its misdeeds and shortcomings? Well, of course, one huge area of vulnerability will certainly be in the area of foreign policy, specifically the question of Ukraine. A growing number of people around the world are disenchanted with the U.S. policy trajectory there, as Europe feels the impact of inflation and higher oil prices, and Africa faces grain shortages as a result of the conflict. The United States strategy has been to funnel over $100 billion into Ukraine of military aid, but the Russian army is preparing a renewed offensive and making at least some gains in spite of that. Under the circumstances, more military hardware equates to more bloodshed, thus prolonging the war at Ukraine's expense. Leading policy analysts like Noam Chomsky have described a U.S. willingness to pursue Putin to the last Ukrainian. And there have been opportunities to head things in a different direction. Prior to Russia's invasion, there was the Minsk Accords, which brokered at least an uneasy detente and offered a platform for meaningful negotiation. Putin also offered terms which were barely given an audience in the United States and seldom even mentioned in the U.S. media. After the invasion began, there were several symbolic negotiations, but they were tripartite, with the U.S. playing a deciding role. Russia wanted semi-autonomous statehood for the Donbass provinces, for instance, and the United States wanted unilateral withdrawal with no concessions. We can all agree that the invasion was never justified and that the brutality of the Russian troops, the bombing of civilian infrastructure, and extrajudicial executions of Ukrainian civilians has been inexcusable and should be prosecuted as war crimes. No one is disputing that, and I've repeated it often. But a just settlement, one that effectively stops the violence, is likely to require some compromise that leaves Putin's regime intact for now, and perhaps even awards some Ukrainian territory to Russia in some capacity. It will certainly require a return to the U.S. pledge from long ago not to expand NATO any further east, and it may include declarations of neutrality from some of the remaining non-aligned nations, and a timetable for withdrawal of U.S. missiles and bases from some of Russia's closest neighbors. all of this, the U.S. is steadfastly adverse to conceding. The war has been hugely profitable for U.S. weapons manufacturers, and it's had the effect of weakening the European Union. Ukraine is also looked upon as a huge investment opportunity for Western speculators who can't wait to cash in on the rebuilding and privatization of critical infrastructure and services, especially in Western Ukraine. A severely weakened Russia, perhaps forced to pay reparations, would not offer much in the way of competition. And if Ukraine retakes Crimea, the West would effectively control crucial seaports and could thus constrain Russian international commerce. Both the U.S. and Russia have strategic interests that depend on the outcome of the conflict, and both appear to be willing to fight without hesitation to achieve them. The U.S. stated rationale has been about democracy and independence and protection for Ukraine, but our history suggests that these have not been consistent principles behind our foreign military interventions. The seemingly dormant anti-war movement in the U.S. has been slow to get past the mantle of hypocritical rhetoric used to justify the U.S. role, and it's a difficult position to take, since the Russian invasion must also be opposed. In some ways, the situation is reminiscent of the U.S. response to Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, except that that was a relatively bloodless action not characterized by murders and torture and bombing such as Russia is now doing in Ukraine. Nevertheless, both invasions were provoked by U.S. policy strategies, and the U.S. interventions were preceded by propaganda and lies from the U.S. State Department. In the case of Iraq, it was Saddam Hussein's alleged weapons of mass destruction and the completely fabricated accounts of Iraqi soldiers killing premature babies in Kuwaiti hospitals. In Ukraine, it's the portrayal of Putin as a despotic expansionist, wanting to recreate the old Russian Empire, a propaganda trap that Putin himself has stepped into with his own reckless rhetoric. One major difference, of course, is that whereas Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction, Russia has nuclear weapons. And whereas Hussein never threatened to bomb neighboring countries, people I've spoken with who monitor Russian state media say that discussion of nuclear deployment has not been infrequent. So, on February 24th, the one-year anniversary of the Russian invasion, anti-war demonstrations will be held around the world. I expect they'll be relatively small, especially here in the U.S., but so too were the anti-war demonstrations in the early days of the U.S. bombing of Iraq. And as with those demonstrations nearly 20 years ago, almost to the day, they'll attract a diversity of opinions and viewpoints, some of which may be disagreeable to others. You'll have people like the alleged comedian Jimmy Dore, who spends most of his time attacking progressives for their lack of revolutionary fervor in his view, and David Swanson, who posits that the two major political parties in the U.S. are practically indistinguishable. You'll have the usual mix of Trotskyists clamoring to claim credit for any and all organizing on the issue, and you'll have pacifists who are opposed in principle to any armed conflict at all. But you'll also find folks who are critical of both Russia and the U.S., calling for a just brokered settlement. That's a position I hope will come to define the latest iteration of the anti-war movement, which needs to be anti-imperialist in nature and should be demanding fundamental reforms in advance of the next conflict as well. In today's show, we'll hear from a perspective I don't typically include, that of the libertarian-oriented antiwar.com. It's an anti-war organization not directly affiliated with the Libertarian Party. And I disagree with libertarians on many things, but their traditional opposition to wars is, in my view, one of the few positions that draws my interest. Well, we'll also have audio from a recent protest in Columbus calling for major banks to divest from fossil fuels, and we'll have a brief refresher on the situation at Oak Flat in Arizona in advance of the annual march by the Diné people of San Carlos to stop a giant copper mine from destroying a sensitive wildlife area near the towns of Superior and Globe east of Phoenix.
Hey, this is Dave DeCamp from AntiWar.com. This is Anti-War News for Monday, February 6th. 2023. All right, the first story at the top of antiwar.com today. It's a pretty big piece of news we have here. The U.S. blocked an early attempt at a Russia-Ukraine peace deal. So former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said in an interview that was posted on his YouTube channel over the weekend that the U.S. and its Western allies blocked his efforts of mediating between Russia and Ukraine to bring an end to the war in its early days. So when the war first broke out, Bennett was still the prime minister of Israel, and he attempted to mediate a peace deal. And on March 4th, 2022, so very early, just a little over a week after Russia invaded on February 24th. So on that date, Bennett traveled to Russia to meet with Putin. And in this interview, he detailed his mediation efforts at the time between Putin and Zelensky. He was talking to Putin, and then he would call Zelensky. He was calling them back and forth. And he said he coordinated this process with the US, France, Germany, and the UK. Bennett said that during his mediation efforts, both sides agreed to major concessions. For the Russian side, he said that they dropped denazification as a requirement for a ceasefire, which Bennett defined, he said denazification basically meant regime change and the removal of Zelensky. During his meeting in Moscow with Putin, Bennett said that the Russian leader guaranteed that he would not try to kill Zelensky. And that was basically all the headlines about Bennett's interview were about how Putin told him he wouldn't kill Zelensky. And that, and all the Western media kind of write-ups about this didn't mention that he said the U.S. and its allies tried to block the or block the peace deal. But it is interesting. You know, he said the interview, you know, I linked to it, and it's subtitles in English. It's really interesting. He says a lot about this mediation effort and what he thinks about the war. So you go just check it out and watch it. He says a lot of very interesting things. It's rare to see, you know, like a world leader be this candid about this time period when the war first started. But anyway, so when he said Putin gave him a guarantee that he wouldn't kill Zelensky, and then he called Zelensky and told him that. And then he said just a few hours after that, Zelensky put out a video, you know, saying where he was and that he wasn't afraid. So major concessions. He said Putin dropped denazification, and then he also said that he would not seek the disarmament of Ukraine. The demilitarization was also dropped. And for the Ukrainian side, Zelensky, Bennett said that Zelensky renounced that he would seek NATO membership. And Bennett himself said that the reason for Russia's invasion was that Ukraine was seeking NATO membership, basically that it was, you know, becoming a de facto NATO member. So he said that was a big deal that Zelensky dropped that. And reporting at the time reflect what Bennett is saying here. I remember this. I wrote about it at the time. There was a few reports about citing Israeli officials about how they were getting close to a deal. I'll read from this Axios report. This is from March 8th, so just 4 days after Bennett was in Moscow meeting with Putin. Axios wrote, quote, Putin's proposal is difficult for Zelensky to accept, but not as extreme as they anticipated. They said the proposal does not include regime change in Kiev and allows Ukraine to keep its sovereignty, end quote. So discussing how Western leaders felt about his mediation efforts, Bennett said that then British Prime Minister Boris Johnson took an aggressive line, while Macron and Scholz, the French and German leaders, were more pragmatic. And interestingly, he said that President Biden adopted both positions. But ultimately, the Western leaders opposed Bennett's efforts. He said, quote, I'll say this in the broad sense. I think there is a legitimate decision by the West to keep striking Putin and not negotiate, end quote. So that he said they want to keep striking Putin. And that was the, you know, Google translation of this interview that was done in Hebrew. And then when he was asked if the Western powers blocked the mediation efforts, Bennett said, quote, basically, yes, they blocked it, and I thought they were wrong, end quote. So explaining his decision to mediate, Bennett said that it was in Israel's national interest not to pick a side in the war, citing Israel's frequent airstrikes in Syria, which he said happens about once or twice per week. Bennett said that Russia has S-300 air defenses in Syria and that they could, you know, shoot down Israeli pilots if they want. So negotiations between Russia and Ukraine, they didn't stop with Bennett, with Bennett's efforts, but this is another example of the U.S. and its allies discouraging peace efforts in the early days of the war. Later in March, Russian and Ukrainian officials met in Istanbul, Turkey, and followed up with virtual consultations. Now, according to the account of former U.S. officials speaking to Foreign Affairs, the two sides agreed on a framework for a tentative deal. And Russian officials, including Putin, have said publicly that a deal was close following the Istanbul talks. but those negotiations ultimately failed after more Western pressure. Boris Johnson visited Kiev in April 2022, urging Zelensky not to negotiate with Russia. According to a report from Ukrainska Pravda, Ukrainian newspaper, he said that even if Ukraine was ready to sign a deal with Russia, Kiev's Western backers were not. And later in April, Turkey's foreign minister, Turkey, who hosted these talks, said that there were some NATO countries that wanted to prolong the war in Ukraine. I put this full quote from him in here because, again, I think it's really revealing. This is a NATO country, Turkey. You know, of course, they're pretty, you know, they never really fall in line with NATO, what NATO wants, but still very interesting. They hosted the talks to see a Turkish official said this. He said, quote, "After the talks in Istanbul, we did not think that the war would take this long. But following the NATO foreign ministers meeting, it was the impression that there are those within the NATO member states that want the war to continue. Let the war continue and Russia gets weaker. They don't care about the situation in Ukraine," end quote. Just a few days after those comments, Lloyd Austin, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, said that one of the U.S.'s goals in supporting Ukraine is to see Russia weakened. So again, this is a huge story here, another example, and why it's just such a shame and just such a horrible thing that the U.S. did by discouraging peace talks is because now, almost a year later, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are dead, and Russia controls more territory. And you know, they didn't get into the territorial situation, Bennett, in that interview, but the reported deal that they came to in Istanbul was that Russia would pull back to the 2014 lines. But now Russia can, you know, has annexed all this other territory. And apparently, according to this report, this is from Kyle Anzell in this next article here, Biden pushed a peace plan that recognized Russian control over 20% of Ukraine. And this is according to a Swiss newspaper, New Zürcher Zeitung. I probably totally butchered that, but it's usually abbreviated NZZ. You know, this is unconfirmed, but it's a very interesting report. And it said that President Biden dispatched his CIA director to Kiev with a proposal to end the war in Ukraine last month. The peace plan that was offered, it was offered at the same time that the White House was preparing significant escalations in military support for Kiev, including announcing that it would send Abrams tanks. So the report cites high-level sources in Berlin who claim William Burns, the head of the CIA, traveled to Kiev in mid-January to meet with Zelensky, and there was reporting at the time that said he went there. There weren't really details on why. But according to this NZZ report, Burns said he offered a deal to Zelensky wherein Ukraine would cede about 20% of its territory to Russia in exchange for Moscow ending its war in Ukraine. Details aren't exactly clear if that 20% includes Crimea as being a chunk of Ukraine or not. But I don't think it did. So anyway, NZZ's source claimed that both Kiev and Moscow rejected the proposal. In a statement to Newsweek, the CIA denied that Burns delivered the proposal. The Kremlin also dismissed the report, so both sides denied it. According to German sources, the peace proposal reflects a growing rift within the White House on how to handle the war in Ukraine. The report read, quote, "Security advisor Jake Sullivan and Burns wanted to end the war quickly so they could focus on China. On the other side would be Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. They did not want to let Russia get away with destroying the rules-based peace order and called for massive military support for Ukraine," end quote. After Burns failed to sway Kiev and Moscow to agree to Washington's plan, Blinken and Austin were able to sway the president to authorize the transfer of the Abrams tanks. So this says, no deal, send them tanks. NZZ reports that the decision for the U.S. to send main battle tanks to Ukraine caught German leader Olaf Scholz off guard. The union in the German Bundestag issued a statement saying that he did not want to deliver the tanks until the very end, because he assumed that the U.S. wouldn't send its Abrams. So yeah, this is interesting. Again, both sides denied it. So who knows if it's true or if the details are exactly true, but Burns did show up in Kiev. You know, it's rare for him to do that. So again, you know, this is going to end with Ukraine giving up some chunk of its territory, it seems like. And that that they wouldn't have lost if they negotiated peace much earlier, and a lot less people would be dead. All right, so the next one here. Germany is open to the idea that a Western country attacked the Nord Stream pipelines. So the Times of London, they reported this last week that Germany is open to theories that a Western country attacked the Nord Stream pipelines in an attempt to blame the incident on Russia. So the Times report reads, quote, "The German investigation is thought to have made little progress so far, with officials having yet to uncover any compelling evidence. However, the Times understands that they remain open to theories that a Western state carried out the bombing with the aim of blaming it on Russia," end quote. So since the attacks, there's been investigations by Germany, Sweden, Denmark. They've been very quiet, suspiciously, I think. Quiet, not offering any details, really not blaming anybody. And there's been reports in Western media saying that there's no evidence Russia was involved. There was a big report in the Washington Post that cited like 23 officials from all different countries saying, yeah, no evidence Russia was behind it. And for their part, Russia has blamed the British for doing it. And of course, they denied it. And we haven't seen evidence that the UK did it. And of course, the US has all this motive for attacking the pipelines as they tried to stop Nord Stream 2 with sanctions. And Victoria Nuland, who she's currently the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, she said in a Senate hearing last week that the Biden administration was happy that the Nord Stream 2 pipeline was a hunk of metal at the bottom of the sea, as they put it. And she was addressing Senator Ted Cruz, Republican from Texas. Both used the term before the war to describe the pipeline, as it was never delivering gas to Germany. Cruz, before the war, was really pressing Biden to sanction Nord Stream AG, the company in charge of the pipeline. The Biden administration held off from sanctioning that company. So Cruz was really pushing it. But so the Nord Stream 2 was never flowing with gas, and Nuland and Biden made threatening comments against it before the war. And Blinken said after the sabotage that it offered a tremendous opportunity to wean Europe off Russian gas. So the U.S. has all the motive to do it. But again, we haven't seen evidence. You know, it's going to be really tough. I don't think we're ever really going to see evidence, you know, that says exactly who did it. But I think it's safe to assume that it was either the U.S. or one of its allies, like the British or the Polish. But we don't know for sure. And I'm not going to sit here and say certainly, but, you know, I'll let you guys speculate on all that stuff. All right, the next one, the U.S. announces longer range rockets for Ukraine. So the Biden administration on Friday announced a new $2.2 billion arms package for Ukraine that includes longer range rockets. So I went over this last week. There was a report that they were going to send these rockets, the ground launched small diameter bombs, the GLSDB is the abbreviation for them. They can hit targets up to 94 miles away, nearly twice the range of the munitions that Ukraine is currently using with the U.S.-provided HIMARS rocket systems. Brigadier General Pat Ryder, he's the Pentagon spokesman, he said, quote, "This gives them a longer-range capability, long-range fires capability that will enable them to conduct operations in defense of their country and take back their territory in Russian-occupied areas," end quote. So the announcement comes after a series of other U.S. escalations, including pledges to provide M1 Abrams tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles. Each step brings the U.S. and Russia closer to a direct conflict. So the U.S. is providing these new rockets through the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, which allows the U.S. to purchase arms for Ukraine. So it's going to take much longer than just sending it from U.S. military stockpiles. According to Politico, they said it could take up to 9 months. So these are precision guided bombs that they're going to fit to a rocket motor that is pretty common in U.S. military stockpiles. They're made by Boeing. They've been pushing the U.S. Boeing has to send these rockets. And this new massive weapons package, again, it's $2.2 billion. And it's broken down into $1.7 billion in the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative. Again, that's stuff that they're buying for Ukraine. And $424 million is going to be pulled from the presidential drawdown directly from U.S. military stockpiles. And one thing, I feel like we're seeing more of the Ukraine security and assistance funds that they're buying weapons as the war goes on. They used to just be shipping tons of stuff from U.S. stockpiles, but those stockpiles are dwindling. According to the Pentagon, the stockpiles, the weapons that they drew from the stockpiles includes more ammunition for the HIMARS, more artillery rounds, mortar rounds, heavy machine guns, things like that. And the equipment, there's a bunch of stuff here. I'm not going to read the whole list, but it's a lot of ammunition and parts for other things that they've already sent. One thing that they say they're buying for Ukraine are two Hawk air defense systems, which are an old system. I know they've been trying to get Israel to give them their Hawk systems. So it's not clear where that's coming from. All right, so the next one here, Ukraine to replace their defense minister after the corruption scandal. So Ukraine's ruling political party, the Servant of the People, that's Zelensky's party, they said Sunday that they will remove Ukrainian defense minister Oleksiy Reznikov from his post and replace him with Kirilo Budanov, who is currently the head of Ukraine's military intelligence. So the head of the Servant of the People's bloc in parliament said that Reznikov is going to remain in the Zelensky government, but he's going to be transferred to another ministerial position. He said that the change was due to the fact that a career military officer should head the defense ministry, not a career politician like Reznikov. But this move comes, you know, he's not, they're trying to downplay it, not link it to the corruption scandal. But, you know, that was a pretty huge scandal, and it resulted in the firing of several senior officials. And one of the accusations that was made is that the Ukrainian defense ministry oversaw the purchase of food and other goods at an inflated price, basically jacked up the price so people could make money off these deals. And Reznikov himself was not implicated in any transactions, but he did come under scrutiny as he headed the ministry at the time of the scandal. Reznikov and other defense ministry officials, you know, they denied that there was any wrongdoing. And they said that the inflated numbers were due to a technical mistake. But due to the scandal, Ukraine's deputy defense minister was forced out, was fired, Reznikov's deputy. So he's going to be replaced. And throughout the war, Reznikov has said a lot of interesting things. He's made very candid comments about the Western role in the conflict. Last summer, he offered his country as a testing ground for Western arms makers in a pitch to secure new weapons. He said, come on, send them over here. We'll be a testing ground for you. He recently insisted that Ukraine is a de facto NATO member and said that Ukrainians were shedding blood for a NATO mission. On Sunday, he's still pitching for more arms. He said he was confident that the U.S. and its allies would provide fighter jets, saying that Ukraine has received everything on, this is how he put it, on his wish, on its wish list to Santa, except for planes. So we've seen a lot of that from Ukrainian officials saying they're giving us everything we want. They're going to eventually give the planes. All right. So the next one here. So this is from Politico EU, which is a site. Normally, you know, it's rare that we would run articles up in our top section from Politico. But this is actually a good article, and it's about this new law that's going to increase the punishment of Ukrainian soldiers for, you know, disciplinary measures for breaking rules or deserting, you know, their post. And it's a very, very critical article of this law. It says, Zelensky refused to veto a new law that strengthens punishment for wayward military personnel. And he's rejecting a petition signed by over 25,000 Ukrainians who argue that it's too harsh. So if you want more details on this, just go read the article. It's very long and detailed. And really, the gist of it is that they're going to expand prison sentences for things like, and they could start making severe punishments for things like consuming alcohol, questioning orders, and things like that. You know, not just desertion here. And it towards the end, they quote soldiers on the front line saying how a lot of them don't want to be there. You know, so many of them are being killed. Some of them have just, you know, fled for their lives before they were told to retreat. And we know that Ukraine's taking a lot of heavy losses in the east around that city of Bakhmut. Russia's continuing to make more advances. It's just a really bad situation for the soldiers, and now they want to crack down on them more.
Check your local Progressive Peace calendar for an anti-war action in your area on or around February 24th, the one-year anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and just about the 20th anniversary of the U.S. war on Iraq. The Biden administration promised a number of environmental protections and incentives to steer our energy policies away from fossil fuel reliance. Among those has been a pledge to convert the fleet of federal vehicles to electricity in short order. But further actions will likely be stalled thanks to Republicans now being in control of the Congress. It will be necessary to put political and economic pressure on the private sector to take action where the government at present can't. That's the focus of a new group hoping to convince a handful of major financial institutions to divest from oil, gas, and coal. They held a demonstration in Columbus a couple of weeks ago, and I was able to speak with their organizers.
Third Act is a national organization. We're Third Act Ohio. We're a smaller group. And the idea is that people in their retirement years have a little more time to protest. We also have a lot of money we can do things with. So the first thing that we're working on right now is to ask people to break up with their mega banks. So Chase is... one of the biggest, it is the biggest funder of the fossil fuel projects. We have Chase, Bank of America, Citi, and Wells Fargo are the four biggest. And so we're asking people, you know, cut up your credit card. You know, use a different, find a smaller bank, one that invests in your local community instead of in fossil fuels. And the other thing we think about is, you know, older people like ourselves who have retirement money, you know, we can talk to our retirement investment companies and stuff and talk about getting out of divesting from fossil fuels as well. In addition, today is the birthday of Joy Braun, who is a climate activist who died this past year. And so the People versus Fossil Fuels is also having a protest today, so we joined together. And, you know, the idea is that, you know, we're being told that, you know, we need to reduce our fossil fuel emissions, and yet we still have these projects to, you know, build more plants, dig more coal, more natural gas, more drilling. And we really need to cut back on that.
Now, putting pressure on the banks worked in the case of mountaintop removal. In some cases, some banks divested from mountaintop removal projects after many years of pressuring them to. But the regulatory environment is constantly changing, with permits being granted and then rescinded and then granted again with the changing of administrations. Right. How do you assess the current regulatory climate, and is that a place where political pressure might be most effective?
Well, I think that it's great that the IRA passed and that we're putting all this money into renewables, but it doesn't help if you're also increasing the permits for leasing. And, you know, look at Ohio itself. I mean, they want to go into our public lands and frack.
House Bill 507, which was passed in the state legislature before the holidays, and they added an amendment that mandated allowing oil and gas leasing on all state public lands. There was a big effort to stop that at the state house. It went on to the governor's desk. There was a big effort to ask the governor to veto that. He signed it. And that would mandate that any oil and gas company can come in and say they want to lease a particular part of land on any state lands in Ohio. It's now before the Oil and Gas Land Management Commission at ODNR. There will be a meeting February 1 at 10 o'clock at the ODNR buildings, and you can look at their website. And they're now promulgating rules for that process. And that totally happened in an unconstitutional way. Ohio Environmental Council wrote comments that said this is unconstitutional, your public process. We all knew it when it was happening. They stuck this little amendment written by the oil and gas industry that's documented. It was written by ALEC, and it's a process they're hoping to institute in other states. So it's very critical. And again, it's just to access the oil and gas on public lands, and it's always cheaper than private lands.
And would that be face legal challenges, and is there a chance that that would go before the now Republican-dominated Ohio Supreme Court?
Now and always.
Well, perhaps. Perhaps if somebody would take it on and litigate it for the constitutional, but it's a law right now. We live in a very oil industry dominated
world.
state, at least, that has control over our politicians. We see that right now with the householder trial and Governor DeWine just turning over any kind of values that he once had into placating the industry.
And fracking is, for our friends here from Athens, that's a big issue. They have people who cannot drink the water out of their tap. I mean, if you've watched the videos of people actually putting a match near their tap, and, I mean, how is that good for anybody? I mean, yes, we need power, but if there are other ways to get power, then we should be looking at those other ways to get it.
Where should the investment come from for renewable energies, if not from the banks or from the government? I mean, renewable, I've looked into it myself recently, and it's absolutely unaffordable for most people. I was very fortunate to be in a position to actually commission a solar system on our house, but most people couldn't afford that, and, you know, and in any other year, I wouldn't have been able to either.
Right. Well, I get that, and one of the things is that when you get more of something produced, the price comes down. So if the corporations and larger entities started buying up solar and putting it on their roofs and stuff, then the price would come down faster. So you look at something like the state house over there. It has a nice huge flat roof that could have a lot of solar on it. You look at school buildings, Walmarts, you know, huge other corporations like that that could have solar on their roofs, and it would help bring the cost down.
And, of course, that would save them in energy expenses as well. So why do you suppose there's been such resistance or hesitancy to engage in that kind of development?
Well, I think that, for one thing, there's already infrastructure for the oil. Although, when we look at the new leasing and stuff, they have to build new infrastructure. I mean, they're building new pipelines. They're finding new places to drill, so that's not, you know. I thought that it would be really interesting if some of the oil companies actually, they have enough money, they could start investing in solar power and wind power development.
And there are some small commercial-scale solar developments around Ohio, but the Ohio legislature, of course, has made that more difficult with regard to regulating wind turbines and that sort of thing. Where do things stand now? Is it feasible or possible for, say, municipalities or small companies to install solar and wind generation?
Well, I mean, I think we see it happening. I think that... I mean, up in Cleveland, I'm from Cleveland. Cleveland has a sustainability department, and they have worked to green whatever they can. Even Cleveland Heights, my smaller suburb, they've put up solar on the recreation center. You know, it's a community that's committed to it, and so, you know, sometimes you have to put a little money out in order to get the savings.
So what more can the Biden administration be doing, for instance, to encourage solar renewable energy development at this point?
Well, I think that one thing that they can do is that they can declare a climate emergency, and then they can use the their legislation to use the power of manufacturing to bring the costs down. I think that would be probably one of the biggest things. And again, you know, if you remember, you're old enough like I am to remember that Jimmy Carter put solar panels on the White House and first thing Ronald Reagan did was take them down. I mean, that's kind of, it's really counterproductive to be that, you know, it's like oppositional defiance disorder. You know, you do it, I'm going to undo it.
Yeah. And George Santos was responsible, too. Right? He was the one who actually uninstalled the panels, right?
Yeah, right. That's right. George Santos did that.
I'll make a suggestion. This is Lorraine Bukoskar. I think Biden has to declare the climate emergency, but do an executive order. No more leases, no more extraction of on public lands, and no logging on forests of public lands. I mean, those are three big things. And then, of course, I mean, there's so many things he could do if he really had the gumption to do it. Really.
And one more thing that I need to say is one thing that people just don't talk about absolutely enough in this whole process, and that is reduction. So one of the things that we need to do is just use less energy. I mean, you look at office buildings that have lights on all night. You look at places that are just, you know, excess, you know, you go into a lighting store, for instance, and every single light in the store is on so that people can see what it looks like. You know, why not turn them on when somebody wants to see what it looks like? I mean, there are so many things that we could do to reduce our energy use.
There could be, like, federal mandates mandates for federal buildings, for instance. We've all gone in these buildings, like, you go in the in the State House right now, it's probably 72 or something. You know, it's like that has to be a governmental process. I mean, individuals can do it in their own space, but and try to encourage that at their city level or the national level, but they need to really consider the crisis that we're under and you know, thumb their nose at the oil and gas industry.
But of course, to get those kinds of federal regulations passed, you have to have consensus among the Democrats and now some buy-in from the Republicans. That seems an almost insurmountable obstacle, especially with Manchin and Sinema still in their positions of power.
Some of that stuff could be done by executive order. I mean, really.
Right.
Yeah,
don't
have a functioning government. I mean, I think we should address that. So any way we can get around it is best at this point.
So you're out here trying to pressure a private enterprise, the bank, to chip in by divesting from fossil fuel industries and perhaps investing in renewable energies. What are your chances of success here in influencing this bank? I mean, it took many years to get a few of the banks to divest from fossil fuels, and still some of them, Mountaintop Removal, and still some of them are.
Right. Well, I think that these kind of protests do work. I mean, think about divestment from South Africa. And we had divestments in the early 70s from, you know, tobacco and weapons and things like that. So, you know, you have to get to a tipping point. You have to, you know, get enough people. It's growing. The movement is growing. You have other organizations besides Third Act. I think that it just have to keep yelling into the wind.
One of the concerns about switching to renewable energies is that you displace some portion of workers as you reduce extraction and processing of fossil fuels. It's clearly evident in the case of coal, but also in natural gas and that sort of thing. Workers are required to build pipelines and a few of them to maintain them and such. How do you accommodate the displaced workers and communities?
Well, my understanding is that there are a lot of jobs in the renewable energies. I mean, you have to train people for that, just as you have to train people to do the fossil fuel stuff. So it's a question of education.
There was actually an initiative at the federal level called the Thrive Act, where communities would be funded, like coal communities in West Virginia. West Virginia lost a lot of their jobs because of the mechanization and the destruction of the union. So it was happening before that, and it's actually a complicit and an unhumanitarian government that doesn't go in and deal with the economic crisis that's happening in those communities. Those are going to be decreased and different, I mean, challenged, no matter what. And actually, there are more jobs in the renewable industry. I don't have those on the tip of my tongue, but, I mean, we should know that, right?
Yeah.
There are total opportunities. We do not need to be stuck in this fossil fuel age any longer. But it's a collaborative. It's a huge process. It's divestment. It's efficiency. It's funding for renewables. It's governmental implementation of, you know, of different processes. It's not just one solution, but the solution is not to just keep burning ourselves up or freezing ourselves up, whatever comes that day.
Could you go ahead and state your names again, and then I'll ask you how to get in touch.
Yeah, I'm Lorraine McCosker, L-O-R-A-I-N-E. My last name is McCosker. And my email is lorraine.mccosker@gmail.com.
My name is Dee Dee Wolin. My email is adwolin@gmail.com. You can also reach us at Third Act Ohio or Third Act OH at Gmail. We do have a Facebook page too.
Stand
as well.
Great.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. What was your name again?
Evan Davis with WCRS and WGRN here in Columbus.
Great. Thank you so much.
Years ago, a deal was made in Arizona to trade a large area of state land called Oak Flat to the Rio Tinto Mining Company in exchange for various less desirable acreages around the state that Rio Tinto owned but had no desire to mine. Oak Flat has been a popular camping and hiking area, in part due to a rare high desert riparian corridor known in English as Devil's Canyon, which is also sacred to the San Carlos Apache, who once lived there and in the surrounding area, but who were mostly relocated to a reservation a few miles to the north by the nearby town of Globe. The proposed copper mine would destroy Oak Platte permanently and would pose an environmental hazard to the downstream towns of Superior and Miami, as well as to the Boyce Thompson Arboretum. The San Carlos Apache folks have been protesting the proposed mine and call for the land swap deal to be reversed. A bill in Congress introduced each year by Tucson Congressperson Rahul Grijalva would do just that, and each year it garners a little more support. Meanwhile, legal challenges to the NEPA process, the permitting protocols that call for environmental impact studies and public hearings to be conducted, have prevented Rio Tinto from actualizing its threat. Here are a couple of video clips from the Apache Stronghold website, one of the groups leading the fight to save Oak Flat.
It should tell America how the United States really is to leave, you know, first American, indigenous person here to face a foreign mining company in our own land. It just should tell everyone that the United States stands on a false foundation. To D.C. and left my letters with Congress and the Forest Service, the Agricultural Department, and told all of them I'm leaving the reservation to come home. I came back here to see the negligence that the United States was doing to our holy and sacred places.
Sanozi Sr. He started this movement of trying to protect Oak Flat when he was a part of the San Carlos Tribal Council.
This year's run is really critical. I hate saying it, but it could be our last. And when Resolution Copper tries to finesse it, you know, it seems to blind people. They don't realize the impact that's going to occur from this. And so we're all going to be devastated by it, you know, our children within the next 20 years.
Resolution Copper will utilize a well-established mining technique called caving. The first signs of subsidence will occur after a few years of mining. Subsidence is expected to continue following the cessation of active mining after closure. The vegetation in this area will be significantly affected.
Our Apache Wars isn't over because no longer are they killing us and, you know, slaughtering our people and putting us in prison. They're going to take our religion away. And that's another act of genocide, because then we're not Apache people if we don't have no religion.
It's a total, not only desecration, but really wiping it off of the face of the earth. And the only thing that you can describe on that is how evil that is.
A year ago in November, I watched my dad say that was it. He was tired of the government lying to him and to his people. So he decided to make his journey home. It took 3 days. Him and my second youngest daughter, they walked and ran all the way back from old San Carlos to Oak Flat.
This is like the new San Carlos, but we're heading towards old San Carlos, where it was Hell's Hole 40, the concentration camp where all the people were brought in as prisoners of war. Yeah, you can imagine, you know, I mean, having direct military oversight on them. And the whole thing was to break us so that they can do as will with everything they wanted from this country, you know. Here's a little glimpse of the monument that I put together so that our people will never forget the tragedy that we went through. I look at us as the centerpiece of our history, the good and bad. There's remnants in the little peaks of the mountains where the military posted their snipers. And so, you know, the Indian people, the people here were ordered not to go so far. And if they did, you know, the snipers would take them out. This is where the Oak Flat runs from San Carlos, where it starts. It was important for me to come back here and start off from here when I vacated the reservation to move back to Oak Flats. It was just the right place for me to leave, you know, from the, where the suffering started to where now for me personally, the healing, you know, then now taking this message across the country.
You don't have to smile. You can look stoic.
It don't matter.
I'm happy. I'm so happy.
Let's get the mean Apache look now.
Okay, the Apache look. That's me.
How do you feel?
Amazing. Drunk.
That's a long run.
Yes. Well, I just kept asking for my ancestors to push me. Push me. That this is my sacred homeland. Nobody can't take that from me.
Run! Hey! You guys did it! There's a reason why you're here. There's a reason why you're here. And for me, you know, I live here, and it hurts because I don't know what's going to happen with that land transfer. We have our lawsuits in and everything. This is a holy place. It's going to be murder. It's going to be killed. It's not over yet. We're still praying for those miracles that America would just stand up and do the right thing.
A lot of people have asked me, like, Nellyn, when's the first time you've started fighting? You know, when did you get in the fight? And I said, when I took my first breath, because Indigenous people were not meant to be here. The United States and its military were trying to make our people extinct, and they failed at that. When our people were free, this was the place that you could be born here and you could die here. And we believe that this is a direct connection to our Creator. Everything here, from the air to the dirt to the water, it signifies a spirit that we believe in. And that spirit is Chochilbetlagotel. And that spirit is where we have our sunrise ceremonies. And this is that place. When these girls have these sunrise ceremonies here, because there's been a lot of girls who've had it here at Oak Flat, they're reborn. And your Dinek lifeline, that connection, is entwined with the place you have that ceremony. I feel that as the oldest daughter, that I have to fight for my sister's life, because knowing the fact that if this crater, you know, when the land subsides from the mine, my sister directly is impacted because she's harmed, because that lifeline is connected to here. So if you kill that, then you're killing all those girls, a part of their life.
As a woman, we talk about how we're able to give life. That's here at Oak Flat. I've taught my girls, that was passed down from my grandmother to me, how to pick the chichil, the acorn, and how it gives life. Those stories, those teachings are in there. The waters, the medicine, the food, our berries, our tunkoje that we make, that we drink, the berry juice, that's all here. As a mother, that's my job to pass on to my children and my grandchildren. How am I going to do that?
Without the oak trees, without her shelter, without her water, without her teachings through the petroglyphs and through the burial sites, it's like we're empty.
It's been, what do you call it, when they throw paint and mess it up. It wasn't like this until this whole issue with Resolution Copper. And when they talked about prehistoric and when they talk about the petroglyphs, then this was all one. Destroyed. It was a storytelling of the life here. From all the medicine plants, the acorn trees, you know, all the petroglyphs, all the holy sites, the homes of the deities, it's all going to subside. Beginning, when everything was created and everything came to be, the deities, the angels around the world, were put in places like this to reside. You have to kind of break away from what capitalism does to you, you know, and give yourself back, you know, to where these things don't classify you, where they don't look at you, you know, as you're different, but take you in as family. There's a whole different mentality that comes in, a whole different feeling. And then you're able to touch life. I think the way the system is that it suppressed so many people that, you know, we're all looking for healing. And it's right here. You know, it's right in America's backyard. But, you know, that's why we can't destroy it. That's why the people got to stand for what is left.
Email guy says, breaking news, urgent notification, withdraw Resolution Copper Mine. And then it states that, good morning, tribal leaders. I'm writing this morning to make you aware of the decision made by the USDA to direct the Forest Service to resend the final environmental impact statement and draft record of decision for the Resolution Copper Mine and the related land exchange. Oh, oh, man. I called on Lynn too, and she's crying. She's at work, but she's had a
time.
Wow. I told the girls, I said, it doesn't protect it completely, but it gives us time. And now Lynn said, let's go start lobbying.
Yeah. All right. Okay. All right. I'm just going to enjoy myself going down slow. All right. Thanks, Nas.
Okay, Dad.
Love you.
Bye, babe.
I love you, too. Love you, guys. You should have
left. Oh, should have left. I don't know if you've seen the birds just fly over me. They're all over me. Just flew in circles. And, I mean, for here, yes, you know, I guess to breathe, I guess. March 11th is not a deadline now. I mean, we haven't totally got it yet, but it gives us a leverage now. Big one. But we can't stop, you know. Got to make sure that this place is protected.
The annual March for Oak Flat will take place next week, and I hope to be able to attend the opening event to gather some sound for a later edition of this show, which is Conscious Voices, and it's heard each week at this time on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. By the way, we are being forced to move our antenna. It's going to be an improvement. It's not a bad thing, but that will incur some expense. So we would really appreciate any contribution you can make. If you go to the website wcrs.org, you can contribute there to our antenna relocation. That'll help keep programs like this and others that you look forward to hearing on the air for the time being. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll see you all again next week for another edition. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.